Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Giles Milton, a writer and journalist who has contributed articles to most of the British national newspapers and many foreign publications. He specializes in the history of travel and exploration. His works include nonfiction, Nathaniel's Nutmeg comes to mind. He's also the author of Edward Transome's Nose and Wolfram, and The Perfect Corpse is his newest thriller. His latest work, published just last month by Picador, is When Hitler Took Cocaine and Lenin Lost His Brain, History's Unknown Chapters, one of the most intriguing titles we've had. And while Giles does write of history, here he's taken a detour into the nooks and crannies of our usual understanding of the world and its progress. These stories tell us of those who skirt at the waves that move us forward through history and are only discovered and brought to light by those, like Giles, who seek them out. The results are history's unknown footnotes, stories of people and animals whose actions shoved or nudged our reality of today in one way or another, whether through the drugs that Hitler took in massive quantities, which may have affected his behavior during the war, to wrecked shipmen who may have wiped out the world's last dodo, from a renowned executioner to the Emperor of the United States. People and their intrusion into our consciousness, thanks to Giles, that may not have altered the course of the world's rumbling path, but are certainly footnotes to its progress. With that, welcome, Giles, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell us a little bit about your career as a writer and how it veered all of a sudden off to this side path that seems like it'll continue on.
Well, in a way, I've been collecting historical anecdotes for years because I spend so much of my time in the archives, particularly here in London, and I are constantly unearthing little stories which are perhaps too insignificant to form an entire book, but are nevertheless are fascinating footnotes that shed light on some perhaps little-known episode of history, or reveal new light on a character from history. You mentioned there in your introduction the Hitler's drug taking. It's a fascinating story of an extraordinary cocktail of drugs that the Führer was taking while directing the Second World War. So it's these little sort of golden nuggets, if you like. You know, if you were metal detecting, it would be the equivalent of finding a gold coin in the sand. They're these little juicy nuggets from history that shed some a bigger light on a historical period.
Well, let's talk Hitler, which is part of the, I guess, eponymous portion of your title. When I read it, and this is a story about how Hitler's semi-quackery doctor who had halitosis and was overweight and prescribed or just gave Hitler. When I read it, I was incredulous because it's 80 different drugs. And I'm thinking, although you do footnote your references, I'm thinking this is impossible. He couldn't possibly have taken this. It just wouldn't have worked out. Yet you believe it. You're telling me this. And at first, because this was the first one, I'm wondering, okay, is he really telling me the truth? Is he making this up? But it really...
Well, I am telling you the truth. In fact, there's a very interesting story behind this because this came out of a discovery that came just a few years ago in the archives. In America, the personal records of Hitler's physician, Dr. Theodor Morell, were found in the archives. These were records that had been written while he'd been caring for the Führer's health. And they revealed that he was... Well, not only that Hitler himself had suffered appalling health, partly because he had a very, very poor diet. He ate this sort of mushed-up vegetable puree virtually every meal. So he had chronic stomach problems. And this is where Dr. Morell first came to the Führer's notice. He claimed he could cure Hitler's stomach problems with a miracle tablet, which Hitler took, and it indeed worked at the beginning. And from this point on, Hitler really had implicit trust in Dr. Theodor Morell, not knowing or caring, really, that Dr. Morell was a quack doctor who really knew very little about health at all. And he was reliant on keeping the Führer in buoyant mood by giving him this extraordinary cocktail of testosterone, amphetamines, opiates, sedatives, laxatives, you name it. He pumped it into the Führer.
Tell a little bit about that. Well, first of all, it's amazing that he could function, if that's what you call what Hitler did. But tell about the story about meeting Mussolini. And
Yeah, there was one notorious encounter between Hitler and Mussolini where Hitler was, Hitler always ranted, but he was ranting far more wildly than normal. And it's almost certain, sort of experts on the Third Reich and on Hitler agree that he'd almost certainly taken an extra large dose of amphetamines given to him by Dr. Morell. And it should be also it's worth mentioning that it wasn't just drugs that are, you know, now classified as illegal that Morell was giving. I mean, he was also giving the Führer cocaine, which was used in small doses as a medicine in Germany in the 1930s. But what Theodor Morell did is he prescribed it in enormous quantities to Hitler, who started taking it to, as he said, clear his sinuses. And discovered that he developed rather a taste for cocaine. It made him feel good, it pumped him up, he was taking this alongside this cocktail of other drugs.
It's absolutely amazing that... And he was taking cocaine, I guess, in eye drops as well.
Well, he started by taking them in as eye drops, but afterwards he started, you know, snorting it up his nostrils to clear his sinuses. As I said, yeah.
Well, so if we continue talking about Hitler, there's the other vignette that you discuss regarding Hitler's nephew. That's a very fascinating one.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary story of William Stuart Houston, who was the son of Hitler's half-brother, who moved to England, married a young English girl called Bridget, and they had a boy who was born in Liverpool who was named William. Now, William, when he grew up or became a teenager, you know, obviously he realized his uncle was Führer of Germany, and he went over to Germany hoping that he could have a job sorted out for him and sort of looked after for the rest of his life. And all went well at first. Hitler did indeed find a job for his nephew, but they soon fell out. They had very different temperaments. And William fell out completely with his uncle. He left Germany. He came first to England and then to America, and eventually gave an extraordinary lecture tour around America, just setting out the appalling excesses, particularly in his personal life, of Hitler, the extravagances and the sheer madness of his uncle. And then he went on to join the U.S. Army as well. So he did a complete turn from, you know, being the adoring nephew of Adolf Hitler to turning completely against him and fighting against him.
And this may be a good point to bring up, is that you oftentimes end your little stories with a whimsical side note, and you do here as well. You say, if he hated him so much, I wonder why. Go ahead and say that.
Yeah, this is very strange that this young lad, William Stuart Houston, the nephew of Hitler, was given the name, or a very similar name, to one of Hitler's favorite anti-Semitic writers. It's very, very strange. What was going on? Why would you want to be reminded that your uncle was the evil Führer of Germany? Very strange.
And then he named his son, am I right? Did he name his son, his middle name was Adolf?
He did indeed, in fact, yes. He again, perpetuating the appalling family bloodline you have is very strange indeed.
Yeah, and that's those I found intriguing, because you'd end the story and then you'd just like tweak it just a bit, and that was always very intriguing to me.
Well, there's often these stories, they have often, you know, unanswered questions at the end of them, which are, you know, intriguing and worth including.
Here's a story that many of us know, but only know kind of nebulously in our minds. I know I've heard it since I was a little boy. It's about Japanese soldiers who have continued to fight, not knowing that the World War II had ended. Tell that story.
Yeah, this is a story. Again, I sort of half heard of this story, and I always assumed that it wasn't true. It's a story of a Japanese soldier who was reputed to be still fighting the Second World War long into the 1970s, you know, decades after the war had actually ended. And I began to look into it, and I found, astonishingly, it is actually true. There was one Japanese soldier by the name of Hiro Onoda, who'd been posted to, I think it's Lubang Island in the Philippines, quite near the end of the war. And news never reached him that the war had actually ended, that Japan had been defeated. So he carried on fighting, first with a very small band of men. Then one by one, they all dropped out. They realized that the war had actually ended. But not a poor old Hiro Onoda, fanatically loyal to the Japanese emperor, carried on fighting for decades in this small but very densely jungled island. So he couldn't be found. No one knew where he was. He wasn't really killing anyone by this point. The only thing he was killing was cattle to keep himself alive. This news came back to Japan that he was still there, you know, still assuming the war was going on, and refused to surrender to anyone. And in fact, it was only when finally his regimental commander, you know, 3 decades after the war had ended, managed to get a message through to him ordering him to surrender, that Hiro Onoda's Second World War finally came to an end in 1974.
And the funny thing you say at the end of that is that Onoda said, "How could we have been so foolish as to lose?"
Yeah, I really like the quote as well, where he said, if there'd been more people like me in the Japanese army, we wouldn't have lost the war.
and as long as we're talking about the war and Japan, talk about first of all what they're called in Japan, about the gentleman who survived both Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, this is another story that you couldn't really make it up. I'm not going to be able to pronounce his name, I don't think, but he's called something like Tsutomu Yamaguchi, and a young lad, Japanese lad, who lived in Hiroshima, and he was in Hiroshima, saw a plane coming over, flying over the city, saw a bomb exiting from that plane, and then next thing he knew, he was knocked unconscious by, of course, the atomic bomb that was being set off on the city. Now, by an extraordinary miracle, he survived. He was rather badly burned, but he survived. The first thing he did was to get on a train and go to the city where his family lived, which was Nagasaki. And he arrived there just in time for the second bomb that went off. So he had the unfortunate sort of coincidence of actually surviving both atomic bombs that went off in Japan.
And one of the things you say that people might not know that I remember from school is that the bomb in Nagasaki, although that it killed less people, was a much more powerful bomb than the one that was dropped in Hiroshima.
Yeah, no, it was much more powerful. An extraordinary little sort of anecdote within an anecdote is this chap, Yamaguchi, was, when he got to Nagasaki, he was in the process of describing what it was like to be caught in the blast of the first atomic bomb going off when the second one went off as well. I mean, he had a certain thing for timing, I think.
I know, it's funny. In America right now, there's a lottery called the Powerball, and it's the highest it's ever been. It's $1.3 billion.
Yeah.
And so people are lining up everywhere. I always think it's funny because they don't want to win $6 million, but they definitely want to win $1.3 billion.
Yeah.
And the odds are now 1 in 292 million that you'll win this, and yet people are queued up out the doors. And just the odds of being both in both of those cities. And yet you say there is a name in Japan for those who survived one. And then there are a few who did survive both.
Yeah, this was, when I learned about this story, I then immediately looked up to see if other people had survived. And I discovered there were several dozen people who were caught in both atomic blasts, which, absolutely extraordinary.
One of the stories that was very intriguing was this: the gentleman Wilfred Grenfell and his adventures on the ice. That was an interesting one to tell, if you'd like to.
Yeah, that was. This came about when I was in Newfoundland a few years ago, and I was told his story. He's something of a legend in Newfoundland. Wilfred Grenfell was a doctor who was up in the on the northeast coast, the really wild bit of the whole island is fairly wild, but that's the wildest bit of all. And he needed to get to a local hospital because there was a boy who was very badly ill and actually had, I think, gangrene in his leg, and it needed to be amputated. And Wilfred Grenfell realised he could either take the land route, which in winter would be a really arduous journey, very, very difficult to follow the coastline, or he could go across the bay, which would massively cut down the distance. And that's what he chose to do, except that as he was crossing the bay, there was a storm, the ice began to break up, and he found himself trapped on what's called an ice pan, which is sort of like a flat iceberg that sits on the water, which began to break up and melt. And he had this extraordinary adventure on this ice pan. So, you know, he was caught in the open. It was absolutely freezing. He had to kill his dogs to use their skins to keep warm. He fell into the water. Everything that went wrong, that could have gone wrong, did go wrong for him. And by an absolute miracle, he was rescued in the nick of time by some friends who saw this sort of desperate figure way out to sea, being washed out where he would surely have died. They rescued him, took him to the local hospital where he performed the operation on the boy, and the boy lived to tell the tale. So it has a very happy ending, that one.
And that was another one that I found incredulous. And the other one that I found incredulous, and I don't mean it in the bad way. I mean, I believe them, but yeah. Reading them, it's like, how in God's name could this be true? And the other one is the drunken cook on the Titanic.
I knew you were going to bring up that one, because that is an extraordinary story, and it is true, but it shouldn't be true, because it's the story of Charles Joclin, who was a baker on the Titanic, and in fact he was one of the first people to realize that the Titanic was doomed after it hit the iceberg. He was sent below decks and realized that all was lost, and that he, as a lowly baker, was not going to get a place in one of the lifeboats. As you know, there were not enough lifeboats anyway for everyone. So what did he do? Well, what would anyone do in that circumstance? He had two bottles of whiskey. He downed them both, and then as the ship went under the ocean, he slipped into the sea and assumed that that would be the end of his life, really. Extraordinarily, he managed to stay alive for 4.5 hours in seawater that was actually below freezing. And eventually got picked up by one of the lifeboats and hauled aboard. And what's extraordinary about this story is, you know, most people will know that drinking strong alcohol and then going into cold water is a very bad idea because it dilates your blood. And in fact, it would hasten your end normally from hypothermia. And yet, for some reason, we don't know why, Charles Joclin survived this, and a truly miraculous survival, really.
Yeah, especially even if you had been sober, generally you would survive 15 minutes, 20 minutes at most in that type of water. So yeah, but I mean, that's where I had to look to see what your source material in order to actually believe that it occurred this way, and it did. But as you said, it shouldn't be true.
I know it shouldn't be true. And then again, there's a sort of a strange postscript to that story, which is it was not the first liner that he was on that sank, because a few years later he was on another boat that sank, and he survived that one as well, although not with the aid of strong alcohol.
The other one that I did not know anything about were the Japanese bomb balloons.
Oh, yes. That's a very interesting story. I mean, I didn't know that, but, you know, I'm British, and I didn't know whether in America it was more widely known. And this is a story of a new innovation during the war that the Japanese came up with, which was these balloon bombs, which they intended to send high into the atmosphere, allow the wind and the air currents to carry them across to America, where they would land randomly and blow up. And that is exactly what happened. And I tell the story in my book of one really tragic story, actually, of a husband and wife who are taking some children from their local parish church out for a picnic. And they're out in the woods, and, you know, it's a beautiful day, and they've got all their food ready and everything like that. And they come across this this strange thing that's landed in the forest. And they go to investigate it, and the main character in the story is not with them at the time. He just hears this almighty blast and he runs across and he finds that his wife and all the children have been killed by this randomly landing Japanese balloon bomb. It's a really terrible story, and it could have been replicated right across the States. Thankfully, the Japanese balloon bomb did not work as well as the Japanese intended, and while quite a lot landed in the States, they failed to explode or they caused only minor damage. But it was very much hushed up in the American press at the time. No one was allowed to report on these balloon bombs, just in case of causing widespread panic.
And indeed it would have. And
that, yes.
But those were the only fatalities in the United States during the war that were on our mainland because of Japan's. And the thing that was interesting is that the technology was quite advanced. The idea of ballast being eliminated by the altimeter showing that the balloon was too low and, you know, coming into the water. That was amazing. It's like almost like a drone.
Yeah, it was a very clever idea, and also it moved almost entirely under its own power, of course, because it was carried along by the air currents, which were perfect for sending things from Japan, you know, to America, and it took a few days, and then they were there. The chap's name, was Archie Mitchell, who was the only survivor of this terrible tragedy, which claimed his wife Elsie and the five children they had on their picnic.
Yeah, it's funny that in some of your stories they don't have a real ending. Like, most of them are wrapped up very well, but sometimes you can't. Like, for example, another one I didn't know about was the 11-day mysterious disappearance of Agatha Christie.
Yeah, I love this story. This is absolutely extraordinary. And again, I knew nothing about this. That Agatha Christie. This was in the year 1926. Now, by 1926, although she was still quite young, she was in Britain at least. She was already a household name. She'd written a string of very successful books already, and I believe already in America as well. She was pretty well known by then. Now, one day in 1926, she left her house one evening, leaving her daughter upstairs in bed. She got in her car. She drove off. And she was not seen again for 11 days, and no one knew what had happened to her or where she'd gone. It was a complete mystery. And because she was so well known, a massive manhunt or woman hunt ensued to try and find her. Now, the first thing the police found was her abandoned car, but it showed no signs of being in an accident, or it had just been abandoned, and Agatha Christie herself had got out and moved on somewhere. Now, the police were mystified, and there's, this huge hunt for her. The papers joined the hunt. You know, it was good for the sales of their newspapers. They called in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the famous creator of Sherlock Holmes. They called in Dorothy L. Sayers, a very famous crime writer at the time, to try and help in the hunt to find Agatha Christie. But for 11 days, there was absolutely no trace of her whatsoever. And then... she was discovered living in a hotel in Harrogate, which is a town in the east of England. Bizarrely, she checked in, and the name she'd used to check in was the name of her philandering husband's mistress, which is pretty odd behavior. And when she was found, when the police came to get her, she gave herself up. She said, "Yes, it's me." And that was the end of the story, and no one was ever really able to explain what on earth had prompted her to do this 11-day disappearance. The only supposition now by sort of psychologists who've looked at the story suggests that she was suffering from some sort of clinical depression because of her husband's repeated affairs, and that she just sort of switched into this alternative mode, if you like, and that's what had triggered her disappearance.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, in those situations where you research, find the story, don't find a satisfactory conclusion in terms of this is what happened, do you find yourself speculating? For example, in this case, did you find yourself what in God's name could have happened? What was it that occurred?
Well, it begs the question, when you read this, it begs the question, what the hell was going on? Yeah, so you want to know. So, on a case like that, I'd look around at what research has been done. And, you know, it remains, it's nothing more than theories, but I think it's worth including them because it's interesting. And occasionally I will make my own suppositions. I mean, I'll make it very clear that they're suppositions, but suppositions based on the fact that I've read a lot of the evidence, and you know, this is the most plausible explanation of what might have happened, is how I tend to put it. But there are also stories where really they are a mystery. They're the great mysteries of history, and I suppose people also love to read those.
Yeah, and the corollary, though, is one where you explain something and why it was so valuable or why it was so honorable, especially with the dogs and the horses, which we can get to. But the one I'm specifically thinking of, because I knew about it, and it was even a movie called Wind Talkers with Nicolas Cage, is the Navajo Code Talkers. You could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, the Navajo. Yeah, maybe this story is better known in America than it is here. But I thought this was fascinating, particularly the whole story of the American war against Japan, and obviously the clearing of all the tropical islands, Iwo Jima, and everything, and the fact that the Americans, it was absolutely vital for the American Army to have secure communications. I mean, this has been, as long as people have been fighting, it's been essential to have secure communications. But the Japanese were proving very adept at cracking the American codes. And so this is what gave rise to this rather brilliant idea of using Native American languages, people experts in those languages, to transmit codes, which simply, unless you were, you know, you'd been born with that language as your mother tongue, you were never, ever going to be able to crack the code.
Yeah, and who was the gentleman, here's why there's always a side note, who's the gentleman that initiated the idea? That was interesting too. I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, the idea came about from the son of a missionary, actually, who'd been working with Native Americans and was one of the very, very few who'd actually, you know, learned their language and learned it fluently, and with all its incredible subtleties and difficulties, and realized that actually, as a battlefield code, you could just use the language in its straight form because, you know, no one or no Japanese was ever going to be able to decipher it. But they made it even more complex. They used a variety of letters and symbols to replace the Navajo, alphabet, and they really rendered it completely indecipherable to the Japanese, and it aided greatly the American war out there in the Pacific on the islands. That they had a string of victories, which they would have won anyway, probably, but they won them a lot faster because the Japanese were denied any access to their strategic decision making.
Well, I mentioned briefly about in the beginning and just a moment ago about the fact that you deal with both human beings and animals, and one of the horse Stubby, again, this is something I didn't know anything about. Tell our listeners a little bit about how he became a sergeant.
Stubby was a little dog that really became adopted as the mascot of it was the 102nd Infantry Division at towards the end of the First World War. And dogs were not normally allowed to be sent into war, but he became the mascot of the division, and he was sent across to France in 1918 with the rest of the division. And he came ashore, and again eyebrows were raised about a dog coming and supporting the division in the fight against the Germans. But Stubby soon proved his worth because, first of all, it was discovered that he could sniff out poison gas with no danger to himself, and he saved dozens, if not hundreds, of lives by sniffing out one such poison gas attack. But he also, on the field of battle, what he would do is he was able to, when soldiers got shot down or wounded and trapped in sort of no man's land, he would go and stand by them and bark, enabling people to come and rescue these soldiers, particularly after dark when it was slightly less dangerous. And again, on account of that, saved an enormous number of lives. And when the war finally came to an end, he was fated and decorated by the various generals and given every possible award under the sun, and including he was raised to the rank of sergeant in the American army.
And he could also salute.
Oh, that was another wonderful thing. Yeah, his owner taught him to sort of lift his paw up to his ear and give a salute when anyone important was around, which played very well with the troops. I mean, I think he was a complete morale raiser as well as all the life saving he did.
And I guess you have two more. One is the horse. I've forgotten his name, and the other is the pigeon. You could tell both of those stories, so we don't give short shrift to the animals involved.
Yeah, the play War Horse has been very popular in both America and in Britain. War Horse is based on a real story of a horse called Warrior. This was the horse that belonged to a chap called General John Seeley. And Warrior was this extraordinary animal that was absolutely fearless in battle. And, you know, these battles by the end of the First World War, they were tremendously loud, frightening, absolutely terrifying for the men involved and for most of the animals. And yet Warrior, for some reason, seemed to thrive in this environment. And in 1918, towards the war's end, he led the last great cavalry charge in warfare in the 20th century, actually, because of course the First World War came to an end very shortly afterwards, but successfully led to the routing of the German soldiers. So he played a very, very significant role in those dying months of the First World War.
So, as you why did you divide the book into two sections? Just out of curiosity.
Well, it was originally published in Britain as four short e-books.
Right.
And so the American publishers decided to keep that format, but they published the first two as a print book, and they will later publish the other two as a second print book.
As you write your history books, I guess you're constantly, either through marginalia or on index cards, noting little things like this. So I guess you'll continue to do this, right?
Oh, yeah, I collect these stories and anecdotes because I find them fascinating. You know, with history, it's I think when you're writing narrative history and telling a story, the anecdotes about people, these personal details about people's lives, they're very important in bringing a story to life and in making it real. People can identify with other people and what they've been through. And so these, you know, the vast number of stories in my collection here are based on people's personal stories, personal anecdotes. I think they're vital in allowing a story to sort of spring off the page.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, too, when you think about the concept of the cult of personality, you think of Potsdam and you think of these four people that changed the course of Hitler, you know, Stalin, Churchill, Roosevelt and Hitler.
Mm.
And you think, basically, it's these human beings. It wasn't technology, it wasn't an army, it was the decisions that these four men made during a 5-year, 6-year period. But then, from the extinction of the dodo to war horse to warrior, you know, these things too, it's like... my kingdom for a horse, for the want of something, you know, of a war was lost. And some of these little things that you're talking about could very well have been a pivotal point in terms of our history, right?
Yeah, I think that's what the stories that particularly interest me are the ones that shed light on another world and really open a window on another, on a period of history, a chapter of history that perhaps, you know, people might not know about. I think those are, yeah. For example, there's a story of a young Chinese lad who opts to be castrated.
It's
a terrible story.
It's horrible.
In 1911, yeah, because he wants to become a eunuch in the imperial court. So I tell the story of this unfortunate lad who was indeed castrated, became a eunuch, but it was just at the very moment when the imperial court fell from power. So it was all in vain because of the whole idea of this vast army of eunuchs serving the emperor all fell apart at that point. Now, this story sort of demonstrates what I'm trying to do because it's an individual, a personal story, a highly personal story, which not only tells the story of this chap Sun Yao Ting, but it also opens a window on the dying months and years, if you like, of the imperial court. So a whole historical epoch is coming to an end, and this character seems to sort of personify or represent much of what is taking place in China at the time. So that's exactly the sort of story I'm looking for.
Well, this doesn't sound right, but apropos of somebody having their genitalia cut off, that reminds me of the other story in your book that you should tell also, about the seductive woman whose treacherous sexual practices led to a similar situation.
This is just horrific, this story.
It's horrific, plus she got away with it.
I know. This is the story, yeah, of a Japanese woman called Sada Abe, I think you pronounce it. And she was... she had a very active sexual life, should we put it like that, and she wanted to push the bounds of sexuality as far as possible. And she found, she started off as a geisha, and then she had worked as a prostitute, and she ended up with this willing partner who was willing to go along with her experimentation in bed, which was to be rather unfortunate for him, because after numerous sort of, they used to do this auto-asphyxiation and all sorts of strange things to try and heighten the pleasure, sexual pleasure, by pushing up their heart rate and all sorts of weird things. Anyway, at one point, the lover just fell unconscious because he'd auto-asphyxiated himself slightly too much, at which point Sada Abe decides to chop off his private parts and keep them for herself. And as you say, it ended up in she was arrested. There was an enormous and very celebrated, infamous, shall I say, judicial case. She was found guilty, but then she served virtually no time, and she became actually a complete celebrity in Japan. Utterly bizarre story, really.
Plus, we won't even go into what she did. Let's not go into
it. No, I didn't. I wasn't sure whether that could be said on air, actually. But, if your listeners want to know exactly what she did, I set it all out in the story in the book.
Yeah, that's a good way to get people to buy the book.
Exactly.
Well, the one here, here's the last one that I knew nothing about. And again, I was thinking, well, how could this possibly have happened? So we can end it on this one, is... Emperor Norton of the Emperor of the United States.
Yeah, this is great. This is Emperor Norton, who is this chap from San Francisco, who I think he must have been a little mad, it has to be said, but in 1859, he suddenly announced to all the local newspapers that he was declaring himself Emperor of the United States. He just thought that the country was going to rot, it wasn't being ruled correctly, morals were going down the drain, and he was going to restore America to greatness, and he felt that what America needed was an emperor. Now, Emperor Norton might have been treated as a joke, but the newspapers of the day took him rather seriously, and they reported on all this, and, seriously, I say seriously, but probably half seriously, but the people of San Francisco initially, then the whole of California, and then the whole of the United States just found this absolutely wonderful, this completely eccentric, flamboyant character going around issuing imperial decrees, abolishing the Senate, all those sort of things he did. And he dressed the part as well. He had an imperial costume, and he used to walk, stride through the streets of San Francisco with his imperial cane and his crown and his cloaks and everything. It's just a wonderful, colourful story. Obviously, caught the mood of the day and brightened up people's lives. And it's sort of been pretty much forgotten now. But he's still, apparently, his tombstone is still there in San Francisco. You can still see it. It still says, Norton, Emperor of the United States.
Now that I think about it, it's not really incredulous, because now I'm thinking of Donald Trump.
Yes. Oh dear.
And actually, let me ask, since I have you on the line, what does everyone over there think of what we're doing?
But people in this country are just incredulous about Donald Trump. They think he's a complete dangerous idiot. The things he spouts about England are just so fantastically, wildly wrong that, he's got absolutely no credibility at all. The slightly alarming thing is that, he's front runner in the Republican race. I mean, it's already Sarah Palin, rang a lot of alarm bells a few years ago in Europe and certainly in Britain. And Trump is doing exactly the same thing. I don't know if you know that there's going to be a debate. I think it's going to take in Parliament here as to whether Trump should be banned from ever coming to Great Britain.
I would love that to occur, but I'm afraid that Britain is too judicious to do it simply because all he's doing is speaking at this point. So I understand that 500,000 people have signed a petition, but it might be very difficult and then perhaps unconstitutional, but I would certainly like it to happen. I remember seeing an interview with John Cleese when Sarah Palin was running, and he said, "I always thought Michael Palin was the funniest Palin."
That's very good. Yeah, I like that. I like that. But she was, no one here could believe the absolute ignorance that she had about foreign affairs, and I don't think Trump is much better.
No, nor are any of the Republican candidates, nor are any of the, I'm not going to do this. I always do this on the radio and then I get so many people, because unfortunately, in my opinion, as my brother always says, I say to him, "Why are these elections so close?" And he goes, "Sam, they're close because there's 50% of the people that feel this way and there's 50% of the people that feel that way."
Yeah, yeah.
And he's very right.
Of course, it's very different. I mean, certainly in Britain, the overwhelming majority of British people always prefer a Democratic president. That's a given, I think. It's very rare that a Republican president has huge appeal in Britain and Europe. And Ronald Reagan is an obvious example. He was absolutely loved, but there are plenty more who aren't loved over here.
I think the reason Reagan was loved so much is because that he and Margaret Thatcher had such a wonderful working relationship together. I think
he looked the part.
Yeah.
He had great lines, it wasn't scripted. He came out with his witty one-liners, and the one I remember is when in the assassination, when "Honey, I forgot to duck," things like that just played very well, I think, with a general audience.
Yeah, it seems as if because of the age of Twitter, actually, it's what's very strange is that this campaign is being run through Twitter, which is, anathema to me. That one day Donald Trump will say "liar," like he's an eighth grade girl saying something to her girlfriend she doesn't like anymore. It's just such a juvenile way of conducting a campaign.
It's not great. It's not good for politics generally, I don't think.
Well, we've veered away from your book now, which I tend to do. But in any event, it's a wonderful book, and I look forward to the continuing publication of sequels. And is it still available as an e-book?
That I'm not sure about, actually.
I think it is available. I have it from Kindle on my iPad now, but I don't think it was as inexpensive as it was early on in the
public. I get so confused as well because they're all done with different territories. So a British Kindle or ebook is not necessarily available to the American market. They have to do a separate edition. So I'm not sure. All I know is this paperback is just out in the States anyway.
Yeah, just it was published here in the United States in January 6th.
Yeah, just a few days ago, yeah.
So in any event, thank you so much for being here. I really enjoy. I could go on each of these stories, but we certainly don't have time. But yeah, I would highly recommend this to anyone who is a history buff or not, because you'll learn things in each of these chapters after chapters. So thanks so much for being here with us today. I really enjoyed it.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
That was Giles Milton talking to us about his book, When Hitler Took Cocaine and Lenin Lost His Brain, History's Unknown Chapters. Unusual title, maybe it's not something that you would normally think you would open up, but definitely do, because the stories in it are, you can pick it up anywhere, because each story is just a few pages, so you don't have to read it from front to back. You can pick it up anywhere, and, if you're, going to the doctor or something, it's the perfect thing to be reading, because you know, you can read a short story or short tale and then come back to it and read another one. And they are all food for thought. And generally, because most of them I didn't recognize or know about before, does give you a new insight into that portion of history, whether it's World War One or World War II. So continue to join us every week on The Avid Reader for what I consider insightful and engaging discussions with most of today's, and actually it is true, most of today's best-selling and compelling authors. Upcoming, we have Lawrence Hill, who's going to discuss his latest release, The Illegal, and several other prominent and upcoming authors, male and female, who will be joining us in the next few weeks. So thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader, and we hope to see you next week.